Nice to be back here again and see many familiar faces in the audience, as well as a number of new faces. So what I thought I would talk about today is some recent work that I've been carrying out with various collaborators concerning inflation and interest rates and an interesting connection with information. This is a piece of work that has been developed both in a discrete time setting and a continuous time setting. In some respects, the continuous time setting is an easier one to present, and so I'll focus the discussion today mostly in that context, and this will act as a kind of an appetizer for the discrete time theory, which can be found in a draft paper that we have, which has this title, which can be downloaded at the King's College Mathematics Department website, which is there just by following the obvious links. So what I want to do is to describe various relationships between models for inflation and models for interest rates, and I'll follow this sort of general outline. First of all, I'll make a few general remarks about modeling frameworks for inflation, and in particular, I'll introduce the key idea of real or and nominal pricing kernels, or so-called state price densities. These are the sort of mathematical objects that we use to ensure absence of arbitrage and to describe the relationship between future prices and present prices. And then I'll talk about index-linked bonds and the various analogies that one can develop between foreign exchange and inflation. And then I'll say a little bit more about real interest rates. And then this leads up to a discussion of the dynamics of the consumer price index, and then finally a discussion of macroeconomic models for pricing inflation derivatives. And this is really, I think, the topic that is of interest. How does one relate the models that are commonly used in mathematical finance to the type of models that economists like to use in the context of macroeconomic settings? Let me begin by making a few general remarks about the modeling of inflation. We're interested in developing models for inflation, and by that I mean models for the dynamics of consumer price index and for real interest rates. But we're also interested in pricing inflation-linked financial products. This is a, broadly speaking, important growth area in finance that all of us, in one way or another, are looking towards the longer term with regard to our financial future. And one of the most important ingredients that comes into this is the issue of how inflation may or may not affect our longer-term investments. Pension plans, in particular, come to mind in this respect. And I'll give you an example, just to sort of kick things off, of the sort of issues that arise. This comes from the United Kingdom, although most countries have their own versions of this kind of problem. In the United Kingdom now, when one reaches a retirement age, then typically one can take the funds that are available in a pension fund and form an annuity. And this annuity can be drawn in one of two different ways. And one at the retirement age has just a single option to choose between the two different forms of annuity. And the one form of annuity is one that is essentially a flat annuity. You pick a certain choice of annuity that will pay at a certain rate, let's say 4%, and then for the rest of your life, based on the total funds that are at that point present in your pension account, then one will be paid this annuity. Then the other one is to choose an inflation-linked annuity. So instead of getting paid a flat percentage of that sum each year for the rest of your life, you'll get an index-linked payment, which will typically go up with inflation. So the letter sounds attractive, of course, but the catch is that the actual rate that you get when you start the whole thing off will be much lower on the basis of the inflation-linked annuity than a non-linked annuity. And so when somebody reaches, let's say, the age of 65 or whatever their retirement age is, and they look at the sort of naked figures of what they're going to be paid from that point onwards, it might be very tempting to take the non-linked annuity, which is going to put much more cash into their bank account on a regular basis up front than the inflation-linked case. So the question is, well, how are these choices being made? What's the best advice for people in that sort of position? That's one type of question you can ask, but an even more important set of questions you can ask are the following. Namely, is it possible to come up with some arrangement where you can offer people a much more flexible amount of optionality in their retirement arrangements? It seems a little bit unfair to make somebody take a choice at a certain critical age and then a year or two later suddenly find themselves regretting it and having nothing to do about it. Of course, everybody makes wrong decisions from time to time, but one would want an arrangement whereby, you know, with maybe some modest penalty, one can somehow adjust the situation and get back into a better arrangement rather than being stuck with it for the rest of your life. Well, this involves essentially the design of more flexible inflation-related financial products. And I think as the years progress, there'll be much more interest and indeed demand for such arrangements. Well, that's some of the motivation for the design of inflation-linked products that I think will appeal to everyone's intuition. As for the modeling of inflation, of course, the economists have been looking at this for decades, or one might even say for centuries. The modeling of inflation in the context of mathematical finance is more recent. There has been a lot of work that's been carried out over the last decade, and I think it's fair to say that the way that one extends the standard Heath-Jarrett-Morton theory to cover inflation is reasonably well understood now. The basic idea is that one treats the consumer price index as if it were the price of a foreign currency. And then the foreign interest rate system plays the role of the real interest rate, and then the domestic interest rate plays the role of the sort of nominal interest rate. So with that sort of parallel, then one can develop a nice, as it were, multi-currency type HJM theory that describes inflation. One thing that's important to remember is that we tend to talk about inflation in a kind of loose and general way, but in reality there's no one inflation. There are many different types of inflation, and it all comes down to the level of detail at which you want to segregate prices into different categories. So when the newspapers in their headlines talk about inflation going up by such and such in figures, well, they'll typically have in mind one or another of various broad indices, but one has to look closely and find out what prices are actually being represented. Also, one doesn't want to confuse what you might call the normative aspects of the subject, where you're debating whether a certain type of price should be included in an index or not, you know, like housing, and the what you might call the development of the theory, which will happily take whatever index is proposed and then proceed, you know, to discuss issues relating to the pricing of products relating to that particular type of index. So we'll, for the most part, take the latter point of view, but of course there are always interesting implications for the normative issues. My view on this is that one should try to understand the theory first, and then once you get a good grip of it, then that puts you in a strong position to go back and start arguing politics and so on and so forth relating to inflation, which of course is quite interesting stuff. Well, I think it would be useful to start by taking a glance at one or two typical charts of inflation. This one shows inflation in the United Kingdom. This is the plot of the movements in the consumer price index annualized, and this is spread over about 200 years here. This is kind of revealing because one thing that you see is that in the 19th century, the general pattern of movements of the consumer price index is quite different from what one sees in, let's say, the 20th century. In the 19th century, one can see that prices were, on average, on the whole stable. That's to say, one saw fluctuations in prices. They would move up 10% or 15% and so on and so forth, but there were always compensating movements in the prices, and so on average one didn't see much movement. But this picture tended to change rather drastically in the 20th century, when on the whole there was much more by way of upward movement than there was by way of downward movement. With the various catastrophic effects that it had on various economies. And Britain, on the whole, fared reasonably well during the 20th century compared to some of its European cousins. Well, here's, by way of contrast, a picture of inflation in Japan. This is over the last 50 years or so, and you'll see that in Japan, despite various ups and downs in their post-war situation, on the whole, inflation has been at moderate levels. One sees a sort of average figure of around 5% in the post-war period, and then there is a blip upwards along with many Western countries in the 70s, and then once that was recovered from, then the annual movement of the consumer price index went down, and they even went into a sort of prolonged deflationary period over the last decade, from which they're still only just emerging. So here's a picture of the United States since 1914. And one can see the deflationary period of the Great Depression here, and then pulling out of that into the period of the Second World War, and then the relatively quiet days of the 50s and early 60s, and then the chaos that was beginning to develop in the 70s. Here one can see the oil shock and the Vietnam and so on and so forth, and then finally things quiet down again into the 1980s. I think it's always interesting to go and look at these charts and say what happened in this peak, what happened in that peak, and so on and so forth. I beg your pardon? Well, here's yes, of course, this kind of and one does see interesting correspondences. In fact, there is a strong linkage between the whole of the Americas, Europe, in the 20th century. Japan is kind of an anomaly, and their system. Nevertheless, one sees echoes of the blips even in the Far East. But here's an interesting superposition, since you've mentioned that. This is this looks at crude oil prices in the United States over the last 50 years or so. Here we've plotted a slightly different chart. These are prices in U.S. dollars, and one sees here the nominal oil price. By nominal, I always mean the price that was quoted at the time in U.S. dollars. Versus the inflation-adjusted price. So if you were to bring everything and describe it in today's U.S. dollars. And one sees this interesting fact, which I think is reported in the newspapers from time to time, that even though the oil prices now are regarded as being very high, that nevertheless, after you adjust for inflation, if you go back to the period of the oil shock in the 70s, you'll see that the oil prices were, if anything, even higher when they reached their peak. And so then one can sober up a little bit in the discussion about the oil prices today. Well, this sort of illustrates that that when you look at figures on an inflation-adjusted basis, then one gains some insights, you know, into the true financial pictures, you know, when you take a historical perspective. So I was mentioning, you know, these various blips here. If one looks in the period of the early 1970s, there was, you can see this rising trend of inflation, and this played a big role in the elections in the early 1970s. You'll remember that Nixon was running for re-election, and how different history would have been, you know, had he lost that election. But he won the election, and do you know why he won the election? Well, there, you know, this isn't a political issue. It's all about, you know, how he managed to pin down his opponent in a debate. And it turned out to all be about inflation. And Nixon, I mean, he had his flaws, so to speak, but he, you know, he was a sharp fellow. And so in one of these debates, when he was criticized on the inflationary policy, Nixon announced that although it's true that the rate of inflation was going up, but nevertheless that the rate of inflation, that inflation was increasing, was actually decreasing, and his opponent couldn't really handle this, and this was clearly the first time that a U.S. president, and maybe the last time, used a third derivative in order to succeed in his ultimately in his case for re-election. So now let me say a little bit about interest rate models before we get into inflation. I'll assume that everybody knows what an interest rate model is in general terms, but I'll try to be a little bit more specific in mathematical terms. What we'll do is to say an interest rate model consists of the following. It's a probability space with a filtration and a process B, which we'll call a nominal money market account, which can be expressed as an exponential of an integral of an interest rate, which we call the short rate, which we assume to be positive. And then a system of discount bonds for all maturities, which we assume to satisfy the usual relations that we require for discount bonds. And then finally, a pricing kernel, which is a process also known as a state price density, which Bjorn was referring to in his talk earlier, or stochastic discount factor, and so on. Now, the key property that a pricing kernel has is that if you multiply it times any of the basic non-dividend paying assets, such as the money market account or the discount bonds, then the resulting processes are martingales with respect to the given measure and filtration. And the measure here is always the real probability measure, not, say, the risk-neutral probability measure. So those are the various ingredients. And we require that the assets have this property with respect to the pricing kernel, that if S is any asset price process, and if D is the corresponding dividend stream, which for simplicity let's assume is continuous, then if we multiply pi times S and add to that the integral of pi times D, then the result is a martingale. And that's how we bring in dividends and cash flows into the situation. So those are the general requirements we want for an interest rate model. Anything that satisfies those conditions, or maybe slight variations thereof, we'll call an interest rate model. Now, for the purposes of what we'll be talking about today, we'll assume that the market filtration is associated in the standard way with a multi-dimensional Brownian motion. So when these various ingredients are in place, then we have an interest rate model. And if H is a contingent claim, so that's a random cash flow occurring at time big T, then the value of that cash flow at an earlier time is obtained by taking the conditional expectation with respect to the information in a given filtration of the product of the cash flow times the pricing kernel at time big T, dividing that by little t. So that's the sort of basic finance theory that will go into these models. So now, given all of that, how do we go about looking at inflation? Well, the idea here is that we're going to treat the consumer price index, which is this index that measures sort of averages of prices of consumer goods and services like meals and restaurants and so forth. And we'll refine the notation a little bit because we'll write pi n for the nominal pricing kernel and p n for the nominal discount bonds. So pi n will be the pricing kernel that we use if we're trying to price any asset that's denominated in the base currency. And then these are the discount bonds associated with the base currency. Then given that setup, well, a discount bond pays off 1 unit of cash at maturity. So that means by the pricing formula that the value of a discount bond at time little t will be given by the conditional expectation of the pricing kernel times that 1 unit of cash. So that gives you your formula for discount bonds. Now one can work out the associated dynamics, and this is what you discover that the dynamics of the discount bond system look like. So there's a sort of Ito equation here, and that omega is the volatility of the capital T maturity discount bond. R is the nominal short rate, which we met earlier. And then lambda here is the market price of risk expressed in nominal terms. So it's the excess rate of return per unit of volatility for assets when they're priced in nominal terms. Now, where these two things come from, they're essentially the drift and the volatility of the nominal pricing kernel. There's a minus sign. So this is how we identify the short rate and the market price of risk in nominal terms. So one can see that the discount bond dynamics gives rise essentially to an interpretation of the drift and the volatility of the nominal pricing kernel. We define R and lambda in this way, and then we discover by looking at the dynamics of the discount bonds that R is the rate of return of a bond that is just about to mature, and then lambda is the excess rate of return of a for any bond per unit of volatility for that bond. Well, it's interesting to note that there, when you're talking about interest rate systems, there are two different ways of expressing or representing an interest rate system. One is by specifying the short rate and the market price of risk, and then the other is specifying the initial discount bond system, the market price of risk, and the volatilities. If you look at the literature of interest rate theory, it's kind of puzzling at first because it looks like one's talking about two different types of interest rate models, namely those that are based on modeling the short rate in some way and those that are based on modeling the volatility in some way. But in fact, these two different, apparently different systems for describing interest rates models are completely equivalent. That's to say, any model that can be described according to the first scheme can also be described according to the second scheme, and vice versa. So this approach where you model the volatility is very popular in investment banks. It's been used over the last 15 years or so as a sort of a dominant methodology for putting together models for exotic interest rate derivatives. But any such model with a little bit of work can be described equivalently as a model for the short rate together with the market price of risk, or to put it another way, as a model for the pricing kernel. So when we talk about modeling pricing kernels as a basis for interest rate modeling, it's not as though one is proposing some theory that's completely different from what's being done now. It's just that it's being repackaged in a different way. So that's sort of an important point. So the next ingredient is to introduce the consumer price index. So the idea is that at first we'll introduce this on an ad hoc basis. We'll say that maybe this government statistics office hands us this price process, and that's what our model is going to be, and we have to work with it. But later, when we look at the macroeconomics of the situation, we'll try to explicitly devise a model for the consumer price index. So if you have such a price index, one's tempted to write down the standard arbitrage-free dynamics of a risky asset. You would say, well, it's a price index, and that's sort of like a price, and prices have to be subjected to dynamics of no arbitrage. But this is not immediately obvious that you can do that, because after all, the price index includes things like a haircut or a meal in a French restaurant. And how can you arbitrage a haircut? I mean, you can't go short and so on and so forth. So it's some people do, maybe one or two people in this room, but there's a limit ultimately. So one would like to think that in some sense the natural arbitrage-free dynamics apply, but one has to deduce this. It's not something that can be assumed straight away. So instead of trying to model C directly, what we'll do is we'll model a related family of asset prices. But these are prices of things that do exist in the market and therefore can, in principle, be subjected to the usual rules of absence of arbitrage. So in particular, we'll look at index-linked bonds. Now, index-linked bonds are bonds whose coupon payments and principals are inflated in appropriate ways through indexation. There are many different types of these. Their actual structure is rather complicated. So when we try to develop a theory, we don't try to model the real bonds, directly, but instead we abstractify and we model an index-linked zero-coupon bond. So what is that? Well, an index-linked discount bond pays out the consumer price index at time big T. So if the consumer price index has a certain value, say $500 at time big T, then this would be a bond that would, when you come to time big T, would pay out $500. So its value in the base currency would be obtained by taking the random variable C, multiplying it times the pricing kernel, taking the conditional expectation, and that gives us the index-linked bond. But now we can express the value of that bond in real terms, that's to say in units of goods and services, by dividing by the consumer price index on each side of the equation, and then that gives you the real value of the bond. And then you'll see that there's a certain nice sort of symmetrical expression that arises here, because what we get is the conditional expectation of the product of the nominal pricing kernel and the consumer price index, then divided by the same product at the earlier time. So this suggests that we define the real pricing kernel as the product of the nominal pricing kernel and the consumer price index. And this is sort of natural, because if you have some payout that is being expressed in real terms, so the payout of some security is a basket of goods and services, which are handed, so to speak, when the date occurs. But you can convert that into a nominal payoff just by multiplying that times the consumer price index. So the idea is that if we want to use the real pricing kernel, well, we multiply the real payout times the real pricing kernel. But that's the same thing as first converting it using the consumer price index into dollars and then using the nominal pricing kernel. So this relationship makes good financial sense. But then the next thing that we can do is we can just invert the relationship, and then we look at it in a slightly different way. We see that the consumer price index has to be given by the ratio of these two pricing kernels. So this means if we have a model for the two pricing kernels, then that gives us a model for the consumer price index. So we can try to sort of take that point of view. So let's look at the real pricing kernel. Well, if we write the expression for the real discount bonds in terms of the real pricing kernel, then we'll see that we get a formula that looks a priori very similar to the formula that we had for the nominal discount bonds. We just replaced the N with a capital R. So that's where one begins to see the elements of the foreign exchange analogy. We're just sort of moving from one currency, so to speak, to another. So then we define the real short rate and the real market price of risk in terms of the real pricing kernel. I say define because we need to interpret these quantities in an appropriate way. So to interpret them, what we do is we look at the dynamics of real discount bonds. And what we find from this formula 11, if you sort of work out the dynamics, we find that the real discount bonds have this dynamics. We have a volatility omega r, and then the drift is given by this quantity little r that we defined a moment ago. So we can see that this is the rate of return that one gets on a real discount bond just as it's maturing. So that justifies the definition of this being the real short rate. And then this is the excess rate of return per unit of real volatility. So that justifies the interpretation of lambda r as being the real market price of risk. Now, this leads us on now to the dynamics of the consumer price index. So we recall that the consumer price index can be expressed as a quotient of the two pricing kernels. So now you can use the Ito quotient formula in order to work out in detail the dynamics for the consumer price index. And one gets this rather nice looking equation. It looks complicated at first, but once you see the details, you see that the coefficient of dW here is the difference between the two market prices of risk. So we see that the volatility of the consumer price index is given by the difference between the market prices of risk of the two different currencies, so to speak. This is a situation that arises in foreign currency as well. And then for the drift here, we see the differential between the nominal and the real interest rate. And then we have an excess rate of return, which is given by the nominal pricing, market price of risk times the volatility. So we can condense it all in this way, where nu now is defined as being the difference between the two market prices of risk, which gives us the volatility of the consumer price index. And the nice thing that we discover here is that the dynamics of the consumer price index is, in fact, of the standard no arbitrage form that one would expect for prices. That's to say there's a volatility, there's the interest rate differential, and then there's an excess rate of return, which is given by the nominal market price of risk times the volatility. Now, why the nominal market price of risk? Well, that's because the consumer price index, after all, is pricing something, namely goods and services, in units of the currency, let's say the dollar. So the market price of risk associated with the dynamics of the consumer price index is going to be the nominal market price of risk. This instantaneous rate of inflation here is given by the interest rate differential plus a volatility term. This is a instantaneous version of what is sometimes called the Fisher equation. It's essentially an idea that dates back to from the early part of the 20th century when it was recognized that inflation, the dynamics of inflation is associated with the interest rate differential between real and nominal interest rates. So this leads us up now to the question, how do we know how to model the consumer price index? We can see that if we can model the consumer price index, then we can price inflation-linked assets. But is the best we can do simply to look at charts like those ones that we were looking at earlier on in the discussion and trying to write down some process that produces the sort of right qualitative features, then taking the parameters for such a model and calibrating them to market data and so on? Okay, so that's basically what the people in the investment banks are doing now when they try to price and risk manage inflation-linked securities. And of course, they do it very carefully, and the models are reasonably sophisticated, so one doesn't complain about the details of what's being done, but one can ask, is it possible to sort of dig more deeply into the subject? Because after all, we have a feeling that inflation is not something that one wants to model on a purely ad hoc basis, but rather has to link up with some of the bigger issues that are driving the economy. It may be that eventually we have to model these bigger issues on an ad hoc basis, but you know, it's always the way of modeling that, you know, one has a succession of improvements, but somewhere along the line, you know, one has to use pure invention. So in that spirit, we'll look here at a macroeconomic model. So we need one or two more ingredients. Of course, potentially there are many different things that could kind of enter into the discussion as regards inflation, but there are two big things that are sort of generally agreed by all economists as being relevant, and these are the following. One of these is the rate of consumption, or equivalently the rate of production going on in the economy, so that's the GDP. And we'll talk about real consumption. So this is, so to speak, the rate of production or rate of consumption of goods and services, kind of all lumped together. And then M is the money supply, the total amount of money. Of course, one has to say what one means by money, but the fact is there are many different sort of categories of money with varying degrees of liquidity. Sort of banknotes and coins are both highly liquid, but you know, money sitting in bank accounts, that's also quite liquid, and so on. So, but let's not try to make fine distinctions between the different types of money. We'll just let M denote in some broad sense the total amount of money in supply in the economy. And then the other thing, which is very important, is the actual rate of benefit associated with a given level of supply of money in the economy. The point is that if money served no benefit, then we wouldn't use it. But money does have a benefit. That's why we all carry around some cash in our pocket. And if you have a benefit, then that benefit has some value. How do you assign this value? Well, that's a little bit tricky because, of course, it's not something that you can just buy. But nevertheless, you can ask somebody how much would you have to pay them for them to be willing to forego this benefit in some way. If you had to resort to a system, for example, where whenever you wanted to buy something, you would have to go to a bank and write out a check and so on and so forth and get the cash and then carry that to the supermarkets and so on and so forth. I mean, those of you who are old enough probably remember, you know, when we would actually do things that way. But now that's no longer necessary. So beta is a process, we'll assume that it can change with time, that describes the liquidity benefit rate. It's the rate of benefit for a given level of money supply. Now, there are two different ways of thinking about K and M. You can think of the consuming as going on by the whole economy, but if that's too big, then you can divide by the total number of individuals, and let's just forget the corporations for a moment. And so we have a large number of individuals that make up the economy, and we talk about the level of consumption per agent in the economy, and then likewise we talk about the level of money available per agent in the economy. So these two figures can be thought on a per agent basis, and then beta times capital M gives you in nominal terms the rate at which benefit is being converted, say in dollars per year, by virtue of that amount of money supply, let's say having that amount of money sitting either in your wallet or your bank account. Now, of course, what really counts is not the nominal benefit derivable from a given level of money supply, but the real benefit. So what we need to do next is to take beta times M and then divide by the consumer price index, and then that tells you the rate at which in units of goods and services one is getting some benefit from presence of money in the economy. Now, our key assumption, and this is one that one needs to make in some form or another to describe the role of money in an economy, is that in equilibrium, the price level, that's to say the value of the consumer price index, and the rate of consumption will adjust to each other in such a way as to maximize the total utility that the economy or the society, all the individuals collectively get from the given rate of consumption and the presence of money in the economy. So to model that, we introduce a utility function. So this is usually called a Skidrowski-type utility function, because this, in the context of monetary economy, this was first considered by Skidrowski back in the 1960s at MIT. And what you do is you take a utility that's a function of two variables, standard utility function, and you make it a function of K and L. So the idea is we get some utility from consumption, but we also get some utility from carrying money around in our wallets. And gamma here is a psychological discount factor that takes into account that consumption at a later stage is less important than consumption at an earlier stage. We're going to just make gamma a constant because our issue for the moment is to try to model the inflation, not to try to look at psychological discounting, but that can clearly be generalized. Now, this has to be subject to a budget constraint for the given time horizon. So the question is, how do we think about this budget constraint? And so here's where the kind of thinking that goes into modern mathematical finance comes into play. You see, we argue, just as we would in any kind of derivatives pricing, that anything that gives value has to be included in the budget. Otherwise, you're missing out some of the money. So this is our budget constraint. We take the consumption, we multiply it times C to get it in the nominal terms, we multiply that times the nominal pricing kernel, we take the money supply, we multiply that times the nominal the benefit rate, and then we multiply that times the nominal pricing kernel, and then we take the expectation, and then that has to be equal to the total wealth in the economy that's available in one form or another for expenditure over the given period. And what we do is now we make a standard sort of optimization using Lagrange multipliers and so forth, and then we can work out the implications. And we find that the first order equations, and there are two of them, tell you that the derivative of the utility with respect to the first variable is given by that expression involving the consumer price index. And the derivative of the utility with respect to the second variable is equal to the same thing. So our first order condition essentially says that ux is equal to uy. Now this seems like a fairly innocent kind of relation, but in fact this is the equation that links the consumer price index, the rate of consumption, and the money supply. So in particular, if you specify any two of the variables, K and L and C, and the nominal pricing kernel, then the other two can be worked out by use of these relations. So for example, if we have an exogenously specified economy where the money supply and the rate of consumption are simply specified, maybe that's all to do with human behavior or government policy or a mixture of the two, then from that we can work out the consumer price index and the nominal pricing kernel. So that tells us both what interest rates are going to be and also tells us what inflation is going to be. So that's sort of interesting because these are the two sort of natural exogenous quantities that we don't have control over, and then these are the results. To make it sort of less abstract, we can just take a look at an example, and then this will sort of allow us to see where this goes. So a very simple choice of utility function is this additive logarithmic utility. For those of you who are familiar with the use of utility, you'll know that logarithmic utilities are very simple, but they capture many of the sort of qualitative features of utility, and they often lead to analytically tractable results, so they're nice for simple models and usually not too misleading in the results that you obtain. So A and B are constants, which roughly speaking tell you the kind of relative importance that the investors or the agents attached to consumption on the one hand, and the liquidity associated with money in the bank on the other hand. So then you work out the derivatives of U with respect to X and Y and equate them, and then this, after some rearrangement, gives you the relationship between the consumer price index, the rate of consumption, and the money supply. So you can see in particular that one's intuition is broadly confirmed by this relation, even though of course it's an example based on a particular choice of utility. But you can see, for example, that for a fixed level of consumption, and if for a fixed level of benefit rate coming from money supply, that if I increase the supply of money in the economy, then in equilibrium, all of the prices will have to go up proportionally. So that sort of makes sense. You know, if the government just on an ad hoc basis decides to start printing large quantities of notes and circulating them kind of secretly and furtively, then eventually people catch on and the prices will move up by the same factor. On the other hand, for a fixed level of the money supply, given the nature of the budget that one has for the given period, if you were to want to have an increase in the rate of consumption, the only way that this could be achieved would be to have a global reduction in prices. So that that sort of relationship between prices and supply is confirmed. And finally, now let's look at the pricing kernels, because we can work out from those formulae what the appropriate expressions for C and for the nominal and real pricing kernels are. And interestingly, in the bi-logarithmic utility case, we find that the nominal pricing kernel depends, well, it depends on the psychological discount factor, but then we see the money supply appears in the denominator. And in the case of the real pricing kernel, it's the consumption that appears in the denominator. So we see, perhaps rather surprisingly, that the that the nominal interest rate system is completely determined once we know what the money supply policy of the government is going to be, over the time horizon of the model. And if you thought that maybe money supply isn't so important, you know, for pricing derivatives, then have a look at the next equation. Because you see, if that's the pricing kernel, and roughly speaking, this says that in situations where in the future the money supply is going to suddenly go way up, then the pricing kernel itself is going to be damped. That's a little bit abstract, but if you take a typical derivative price, well, the HD is the price of a contingent claim, for example, an inflation derivative of some sort. And so to form its value today, you have to take the payout, which is in nominal terms, and divide by the random variable, which is the money supply at that time. And then that gives you the present value. And these are sort of constants that that's the discount factor, should be capital T there. So, but you'll see in particular that if you're dealing with a possible inflationary scenario, in other words, if there's a non-trivial chance that over the lifetime of the derivative there's going to be a large inflation, in other words, so that the money supply would grow significantly, then in that, if that's the scenario, then the value of the derivative will be suppressed significantly. On the other hand, if the environment is by and large non-inflationary, then the value of the derivative, the present value of the derivative, will be much higher. But this makes perfectly good sense, because if I make some contract to sell you some sort of option, and if the payoff of the option is in nominal terms, but if secretly I know that the government is planning to print massive amounts of currency and I'm going to inflate the economy over the next 5 years, and I happen to have this private information which hasn't been publicly revealed yet, then of course I'll make a killing, because I'll sell this derivative to you at a high price, and then the next day the government announces its new inflationary policy and the prices of such derivatives will drop enormously, and then I can cover my position. So that gives you an idea of how, when we translate that to the slightly longer time horizon and pensions and so forth become involved and the options associated with these, then of course there are significant issues that are involved. Well, that's the conclusion of my talk. I'll mention in closure here several of the papers where some of this work is addressed. Okay, thank you.